Welcome to the Nashville Public Library. I'm Susan Earle, the main library administrator. First thing I need to remind all of you is that if you do have any cell phones, if you'll please silence them or just turn them off completely, that would be wonderful. Thank you. November is very special for us here at the Nashville Public Library. Besides having this wonderful program to start off with, on Saturday at 10 a.m., John Updike, our 2006 Literary Award winner, will be here. Again, 10 o'clock, he'll be speaking in our auditorium, and he's even going to stay around to sign a few books. So if you would like to come join us again on Saturday, that would be wonderful. The other thing that we're doing in November is a community of many faces, and these are programs that are about different cultures and diversity that is placed at all our locations throughout the month of November. And if you haven't checked it out, we have a wonderful local artist in our art gallery, Anna Japp, and I welcome you to go look at her wonderful paintings. There you go. I'm now pleased to announce and introduce Beth Fortune, who is the Associate Vice Chancellor for Public Affairs at Vanderbilt University.
Thank you, Susan. Let me add a very big and warm welcome from Vanderbilt to you. The Thinking Out of the Lunchbox series has been one of our most successful partnerships that we have ever done. And we are so grateful to the Downtown Library, to Donna Nicely, and to Susan for allowing us to gather every month in this world-class institution to hear world-class thinkers like you will hear in just a moment. You know, one of the great things about working at a university, and I would say Vanderbilt in particular, is that we get to engage in these kinds of debates and intellectual discussions every day that you're going to hear for the next hour. And we're delighted that we can bring these intellectual discussions to downtown. Thank you for attending today. I hope you will go away fed physically and intellectually and mentally, and we hope that you will return time and time again. Now, it's my pleasure to introduce David Wood, who is the creator and the leader of the Lunchbox series. David is a professor of philosophy at Vanderbilt, and I can honestly say he's one of our great thinkers, one of our most engaging faculty members, and those of you who have been to the Lunchbox series before knows that he asks provocative questions, he leads intelligent discussions, and he always keeps things right on time. So please welcome David Wood.
Thank you, Susan, and thank you, Beth, and let me join them in welcoming you on one of the few rainy days that we've had in this whole series. I thought we kept the rain away, but sometimes it comes back. Just a couple of things, because I will forget them if I leave it to the very end. We do appreciate your feedback on those pink sheets, and we do try and take into account the sort of things that you say. So feel free and empowered to make suggestions, and obviously we try and connect it up with the faculty we've got, but we do like to hear what you would like to hear about. And look at the display when you go out. There's some fabulous books that John and I were looking at. We're thinking, my goodness, we've got to read some of those on the sort of topic that he's dealing with today. It looks really an exciting collection, and thanks to the library for setting these up. This series, Thinking Out of the Box, is described on that card you get as a series of conversations with a philosophical flavor. Now, sometimes, I admit, the philosophical flavor is something I try to sprinkle on rather than bake into the meal from the beginning. With our guest today, my lively and illustrious colleague, John McCarthy, the philosophy does not need to be sprinkled on afterwards. As you'll see, it's one of the original ingredients. John is professor of German and comparative literature at Vanderbilt. He's director of the prestigious Max Kader Center for European and German Studies. And last year, he was an active and vigorous chair of the Faculty Senate. All this is to say that he wears many busy hats at Vanderbilt. And we're very lucky to have him take a chunk out of his schedule to talk to us today. John McCarthy came to Vanderbilt from the University of Pennsylvania in 1991, where he already had a distinguished career. He's held visiting professorships at Swarthmore and Munich and Rutgers. His teaching covers an extraordinary range: the European Enlightenment, Goethe and science, Nietzsche and literature, 18th century literature, the problem of evil in philosophy, in literature, and in film, and he's got a kind of literature-science umbrella connection. He's interested in creativity, in chaos theory, and in complexity theory. John has written 6 books. He's the editor of 8 more, and he's published over 80 papers. The books have wonderful titles. Fantasy and Reality, Crossing Boundaries, Disrupted Patterns, Remapping Reality. You don't leave things alone, do you? They keep changing. Chaos and Creativity in Science and Literature. John will talk today about a certain loss of the vision of the whole in academia, indeed in our culture. But in his own work, he himself embodies that broad Enlightenment vision that he so admires and that so many of us look for in vain. As one more example, he's currently writing a paper on the concept of the soul for a volume on neuroscience and religion. John McCarthy has a supple and synoptic intellect. It's not by accident that he will be honored next month by the Goethe Institute. Today we will hear something of his passion, a passion for education and for the values of reading and writing and critical reflection that education tries to conserve and to convey. And we will hear something of his wit. This is we need a bit of wit as well, right? And something, I think, also of his delight in literature, in words, in ideas, and in images. Please welcome John McCarthy, who will talk to us today about writing and reading in the age of consumerism.
You know, every time I get in front of a microphone, I'm reminded of an experience that I had as a young member of the parish, Roman Catholic. The priest got up to give his homily, and he said, "I think there's something wrong with this thing." And, of course, Roman Catholics are trained to reply quite rotely, and also with you, Father. I suspect that some of you will react that way by the time I finish speaking to you today. I want to say how delighted I am to be invited to participate in this series, and I am very flattered by the remarks that David just made introducing me. I'm only sorry that my wife and children were not here to understand that I really am deserving of respect. I am pleased to address you in this mausoleum, surrounded by the writings of a great number of people who no longer walk this earth. But like all souls and all saints, the feast marked by yesterday's shenanigans and today's memorials, the authors who produce those writings can come to life anytime we choose. I'm going to be showing you a number of slides in the following. Some of them will be shown in quick succession. Others will tarry on the screen for an inordinately long time. That's so that I can delve into some depth on them. The very first slide is one that is close to my own heart, both as a Catholic and as a professional writer. Writing and reading are critical to my profession. As an academic in a Research One institution, I am required to publish. Even those of you outside academia understand the phrase, publish or perish. The cartoon reveals just how painful it is when you don't get published when and where you wish. In the announcement for today's talk, I cited an advertisement for Starbucks Coffee Incorporated. Now, I came across this advertisement just a couple of weeks ago, and I thought, this is really odd. Starbucks is advertising the value of reading. How does one become an astronaut? Why read, of course? I'm going to let you read while I talk about what this use of reading actually addresses. Reading, it turns out, is essential to learning, to dreaming big. It gives voice to new ideas. Reading eventually and essentially has the power to transform an individual. My topic is, hence, reading and writing in an age of consumerism. Starbucks coffee on the one hand, reading on the other. Reading and writing, I wish for you to understand as the core activities of the humanities. And my thesis is that when taught correctly, reading and writing, hence the humanities in general, will contribute to the full development of the individual by promoting a reevaluation of values. Not rejection of value, but a considered judgment of what is of value to you as an individual. A full range of journals, books, newspapers, and conferences have accorded these questions significant space in recent years, and the book exhibit outside along the corridor is an excellent example of the wealth of material that is available. I will try not to bore you with all the academic details of source citing, but I do feel compelled to share a very short, list of recent work on the topic. I'm going to cite two in the following which are not listed on that screen. For example, Profession, which is published by the Modern Languages Association, devoted its 1993 volume to the real trouble we find ourselves in. The July-August 1996 edition of the Higher Education Journal Academe highlights the problem further. It contains individual articles on such topics as public perceptions of universities and faculty, and the self-inflicted irrelevance of American academics. That hurts. Professors, the media, and the balance of power in higher education. Well, my years on the Senate have indicated to me that it's important to be involved in those kind of power struggles. And finally, the title of one of the contributions is, It Came from Hollywood, Popular Culture Casts Professors in a Negative Light. Of course, we're thinking of Eddie Murphy. Some of you will remember Jerry Lewis in The Nutty Professor. The most recent event was the joint meeting of the Council of American Learned Societies and of the American Association of Universities that met on May 6, 2006 in Philadelphia. And their purpose was to examine the question of how to reinvigorate the humanities. It featured sessions on such topics as reading and knowing in the information age, or the public sphere of the humanities. And finally, the making the humanities count. All this underscores the enduring nature of the debates on the role of the university, the scholar, and the liberal arts since Ralph Waldo Emerson's famous Phi Beta Kappa lecture at Harvard of 1837, entitled The American Scholar, and the debates since Daniel C. Gilman's oration on the idea of a university held in 1882. Their debates were not so different from our own, although multiculturalism has tended to dominate the debate today to the disadvantage of an emphasis on the art of reading and writing. Then, as now, the fear was that one would become a parrot of another's way of thinking, that the authority of one's own views would be placed outside oneself. Don Michael Randell. Excuse me, I need to drink water. I think I have a frog. Don Michael Randell identifies the key problem and impediment to placing the authority for one's own views and values within oneself. I direct your attention to the screen with a highlighted passage from his remarks on the role that humanistic learning should play in the life of an informed citizen in a global society. While you read, I am going to summarize the main points. Otherwise, I am not going to be able to meet the timekeeper's expectations. There is an anti-intellectual streak in the United States. Many of us have felt this for quite some time. Thoughtful dialogue has become nigh impossible in a climate which, and I'm going to offend some of you, not intentionally, but it's okay. Some might see in this a Bolshevik mentality dominating. That is to say, your opponent is your enemy, and your enemy must be destroyed. So there's no middle ground for understanding, for collaboration, for compromise. How is democracy to survive under these conditions? Mark Edmondson had argued in a similar fashion when he averred in Harper's Magazine some years ago, "To me, liberal arts education is as ineffective as it is new, not chiefly because there are a lot of strange theories in the air. Rather, it's that university culture, like American culture writ large, is, to put it crudely, ever more devoted to consumption and and entertainment, to the using and using up of goods and images." It must be the dry air within the library. So what we have here is, on one hand, a view which looks to the outside as causing impediments, and here to the inside of the institution, which also causes impediments. What Randell and Edmondson address in the general non-academic climate that hinders the work of humanists is namely that which hinders the humanities in the USA. Mere reading, that is, reading for content, entertainment, or self-absorption, is the prevalent mode of reading and writing today, inside and outside. The traditional role of books as sites of authority has long been a topic that has been called into question again. There is an image of the professor who has become an internalized book as a dogmatic representation of what is contained in books, and has become an example of rigidity. Goethe addressed these issues in his famous play, Faust, way back in the 18th century, and he had his protagonist, the antagonist, Mephisto, speak the following lines, advising a student about how to pursue his studies. "Be in there, the lecture hall, on the stroke of the bell, see that you are prepared as well, with the paragraphs worked up in such a way that you can see with just a look there's nothing said but what is in the book." Universities are rapidly declining into mere knowledge factories, Gedankenfabriken, as Mephistopheles put it in Goethe's play. Indeed, at many universities, the ratio of the number of faculty to the number of students is so low that the students overwhelm the individual faculty members. And so the individual advising becomes really, really strained. Many universities thus are being transformed into Massenuniversitäten, mass factories of knowledge production. Students are becoming more and more and acting more and more like consumers. I have a series of images that will help illustrate this trend for you. And the first one is taken from an article, op-ed article in the New York Times back in 2000 by Arthur Levine on the soul of the university. And it's quite obvious from the image that you see in front of you that the computer or the digital mind has, if you can speak of that, the computer has replaced the mind of the teacher, and that there is an offering not of insight and connection and synopsis, but rather of easily accessible information. Notice, if you will, that the books are in the wastebasket. Eugene Hitchcock expressed his views about a month ago, the beginning of October, on what is happening at the universities. He called it "No Undergraduate Left Behind." Hitchcock actually lambasted higher education and saying, "We're not working hard enough. We don't teach enough." But I think he is right in pointing out that we need to point out what it is that is currently being done at universities. But once again, I want you to have this image in mind as I speak about some philosophic implications. But please bear in mind that these individuals are not naturally rendered. They're not nice flowing shapes. What we have is a geographical rectangular, and square always reminds me of that song, little black boxes, ticky-tacky boxes built all along a row. So if you come home inebriated, you can't find your own house. Of course, you'll remember that. You won't remember that one. It just sticks out in my own mind. I don't know why. And then there's another one, which the men in the audience will be, of course, highly inflamed about. Well, why not the women? And Anita Gates drew attention to the fact that, well, back in 2000 when she wrote this, the rendering of men on TV was, man, they're rendered as being dumb, really dumb, and they're proud of it. Unfortunately, if you watch any football and you happen to stick around for the advertisements during the intermissions, you'll see that men really are rendered as dumb. I don't know where that comes from. I don't think it's genetic in us. I like to think it's not genetic. And this next one is also an example of what happens in our digital world, and we might take time to read it. Oh, says the individual praying to the deity, all this technology has made us feel so removed, so disconnected, so devoid of human contact. Life seems so impersonal lately. And of course, the voice comes down from above. If you want to report a sinner, press 1. If you've had trouble with an angel, press 2. If your scripture is garbled, press 3. If you want absolution, press 4. The number 4 key on my computer is actually worn out. The next image is by the famous Wilhelm Busch, 19th century cartoonist and popular philosopher, in his rendering of the Master of Krevinkel. It is a scholar who, in the German, it says, er legt sich auf die Sprachen und Wissenschaften, which translates, he has devoted himself to the arts and sciences. And the German term is actually to lay down, I lie down on them. And but that is a wonderful image which suggests that the authority for one's own ideas is placed outside oneself. It's in the books which one acquires, but doesn't necessarily read and doesn't necessarily engage in dialogue with. The next one. Those of you under 18, please avert your eyes. Or at least just look at the right panel. This particular image is of the distractions of reading. The first one, it doesn't have any serious consequences. You ruin your breakfast. And the second one, well, if you don't recognize that you've lost the baby, you're in deep trouble. Okay? So these are the dangers of reading from a long time ago. There is also this notion that reading can lead to an inflammatory response, can inspire, can really inflame the passions, either positively, negatively, or somewhere along that scale. And this is actually the one where you should avert your eyes to the from the left to the right, although you might be offended by the image on the right too. Both are challenging us. On the right, we see a young woman who is warming herself before the fire with book in hand. On the it was on the left. On the right, we have, I think that's what it is. The other image is that of the Nazi book burning on May 10th, 1933, which was designed to protest the intrusion of non-German ideas into German culture. So we have to clean things up. It's kind of an ethnic cleansing, which was followed by a genuine ethnic cleansing. Books can be dangerous. In other words, I now turn to a work that created quite a stir. Alan Bloom's The Closing of the American Mind first appeared in 1987. Overnight, it became a sensation. It remained on the New York Times bestseller list for 35 weeks, and it sold in that time frame, an estimated 800,000 copies in hardback alone. It launched the so-called culture wars that have sucked up a lot of energy, print and airtime into a black hole and diverted our attention from really important matters that lie beneath and behind the ideological positions adopted by the William Bennetts, the Ann Coulters, the O'Reillys, the Lawrence Levines, and the Al Frankens of the world. Actually, my defense of this book is not of the entire work, just of the particular didactic thrust it adopts and the manner in which it affects the public perception of the professoriate. In taking this tact, I concur with the stance Lawrence W. Levine adopts in his The Opening of the American Mind, Canons, Culture, and History. Lawrence Levine published his book in defense of multiculturalism and against Bloom 10 years after Bloom's book, and that was 1996. Levine traces the historical roots of the liberal arts program with its Western Civ courses and literary canon. Essential to his argument is the need to put things in perspective by acknowledging the larger social historical framework in which ideas, doctrines, and ideals arose and set down roots, became firm as dogma. Alan Bloom's The Closing of the American Mind has been castigated for tracing the source of our current uncritical reading habits directly to the mind-numbing passivity of MTV and music-laden literature aimed solely at the lower faculties of insatiable consumers. While not total, there is some agreement with Bloom that total dependence on electronic media distorts the public sphere, turning citizens into objects of spin control, image management, and negative campaigning. One of the most positive features of Bloom's Closing of the American Mind is his insistence that the intellectual and the university must adopt an oppositional stance to dominate. As an oppositional stance to the dominant ideology and not simply mirror society at large. When we parrot society, we lose the ability to lead and to offer a corrective counterweight to whatever is in vogue at any given time. Bloom offers us a chance to read in a more balanced manner, one which takes the text seriously while not allowing oneself to lose oneself in it entirely. Excuse me again. I don't know why this happened. This never happens except when I get up and talk. And of course, my family wishes it would happen at home. The novel aspect of the crisis of the West, Alan Bloom asserted, is that it is identical with the crisis of philosophy. Citing predominantly German authorities, Bloom opposes a more open, inquiring philosophical stance to the rather closed and goal-oriented systems dominant since the 18th century. As used by Bloom, philosophy connotes a synoptic endeavor to view the whole. But philosophy in this sense hardly exists today, he writes. Strictly defined disciplines and specialties now dominate our academies. Freewheeling, far-sighted visionaries have been supplanted by social and natural scientists pursuing practical, marketable ends. Of course, I accept all social scientists and natural scientists in attendance today. The crisis of liberal education and of our civilization, Bloom concludes, is ultimately a crisis at the peaks of learning itself. Partial intellect reigns supreme, he writes. There is no synopsis. Understandably, Bloom calls for a reorientation of our thinking. The role of the university for Alan Bloom is twofold, and I think many of us share this. First, its role is to preserve the past. Second, its role is to resist tendency to dogmatize. The role of the university is therefore a seemingly paradoxical one. We know, for example, that the past takes on canonical proportions via the act of repetition in the lecture hall, in print, and in academic conferences or in talks such as this one. Bloom is opposed to what he calls the cultural peddlers, though that is, intellectuals who sell themselves out to the highest bidder. He laments the absence of true philosophy, that is, the lack of the view of the living whole. Although the philosophic experience drives to the heart of what being human really means, the general populace has taken little note of it. Philosophy is generally not popular today, if it ever was, because it does not contribute to humankind's superficial sense of well-being. On the contrary, when practiced correctly, philosophy is crisis-oriented. It makes humans feel uncomfortable, exposed, decentered, weak, robbed of the green pastures of contentment and of self-importance. Far from being the center of the universe, humankind is made to feel nature's indifference to its individual fates. Press 4. Philosophy is a liberating experience, but paradoxically, humankind does not wish deep down to be liberated. It only wants to be satisfied and contented. Bloom believes that only a tiny band of people practice philosophy today as a way of life, instead of treating it cautiously as inalterable doctrine. Yet these persons are, as he says, the soul of the university. Then, too, the proper domain of philosophy is not the university at all. It needs to take root both within and without the halls of academe. In failing to bridge this gap, we educators fail in our efforts to teach reading and writing in such a way as to make a difference in life outside the ivory tower. But it seems the tiny band is about ready to grow. I'm going to give you a couple of examples. There are signs of this changing attitude, a response, perhaps. One is from Vanderbilt University itself, the College of Arts and Science, and its AXL program, which is Achieving Excellence in Liberal Education. What is this? And this particular passage drives to the heart of what interests me today. A liberal arts education is not merely about disseminating information. It is really more about insight, and that is the objective. Information is undoubtedly important. Context is as important as is the content. We should never forget that those interconnections. Establishing moral values of right and wrong is part and parcel of the humanistic experience and the humanistic drive. When practiced correctly, philosophy, therefore, in this version, is crisis-oriented. It is largely dependent on skills in reading and writing, in particular of reading and writing that fascinates by its brilliance and subtlety. Other signs of action to address the crisis in learning are provided by such thinkers as Margaret Duty in her essay, Is Literature Dead?, and that of Ken Seigneur, The Flickering Light of Literature. And I select one main thought from Margaret Duty's talk, and that is the following. We need to tell our administrators and make it clear to the public that real thinking is not a skill, though skills are required for it. Nor is it a matter of information, though information is needed. We need to talk again, and loudly too, about educating the whole person and not the worker or consumer or even citizen. It's an interesting thought. It's a thought which takes this back to the original impetus for humanistic education, that is, educating the entire person, educating for autonomy. Ken Seigneur writes, without reading as a technology of self, and that's the way I want all of us to see this, technology of self, citizens become cynically restive toward various authority structures, yet incapable of responding effectively. Instrumentality precludes the imaginative associations that lead to solutions, and the smoke and mirrors mode of mere rhetoric baffles rigorous development. So we've got to create a space for the imaginative associations, and we've got to be able to teach our students how to develop that skill to imagine. Harold Brodkey a writer in New York, Russian descent, who died about 10 years ago, wrote a really interesting essay in the New York Times back in the mid-80s entitled Reading the Most Dangerous Game. And I'm going to share a couple of excerpts from that with you. This first one is it talks about reading seriously, and doing so is going to put you in danger of changing your views. And we've got to learn to read on multiple levels, not simply a surface level, not just for what it stands out, but what lies behind. In another quotation, he talks about that need to read seriously. He also talks about the act of reading as being an intimate act, and this is really one of those signs that the awareness of the complicated nature of reading and writing really does extend beyond the bounds, beyond the academy. One such instance is this essay, and particularly the passage which is on the screen before you now, when he writes, "Reading is an intimate act, perhaps more intimate than any other human act. I say that because of the prolonged or intense exposure of one mind to another that is involved in it, and because it is the level of mind at which feelings and hopes are dealt with by consciousness and by words. The implicit comparison with a love bond is evident here, yet the union in the exchange of minds is far more rewarding. Because the intimate act of intellectual intercourse is an intense and self-reflective one, which thus has the propensity to change the way the reader makes judgments. Precisely for that reason," he remarks, "writing and reading are dangerous activities. Writer and reader become partners in an activity. They assume a responsibility in entering the bond that affects not just the one, but also the other. Reading and writing, therefore, are, or at least should be, serious business, just like a marriage or a partnership is serious business. You have to work at it. And each of the partners should grow and benefit." That's the kind of approach that Brodsky takes to the encounter of the reader with the writer via the written text. Writing that has the forcefulness to alter perspectives and attitudes abides by the principle of exteriority. It leads the reader into the text and back out again. Such writing has an inner truth and logic bearing on human concerns. It thus betrays a moral stance. It must be approached by the reader in a spirit similar to the one that guided the author's pen in writing it. Such an encounter is an adventure, an experiment, whose outcome cannot be wholly foreseen, although the writer hopes by his or her prose and cogency to convert. In the intimate act of reading, the text engages the practiced and educated writer and reader in a process of argument, and the outcome of those individual dialogues with the word leaves both different. At the very least, the consciousness of the other has been, or should have been, enhanced. In conclusion, I want to draw your attention back to the 19th century. And I want to highlight one of my favorite authors, Ralph Waldo Emerson. Our task as teachers of writing and reading, which is not limited to composition courses, by the way, is to view encounters with the written text, regardless of whether they are canonical or not, as little acts of creation. Reading and writing must be viewed and taught as creative reading and writing. I do not mean imaginative, I mean transformative, in Emerson's meaning, when he concedes that there is then creative reading as well as creative writing in the American Scholar. That creative act is described admirably and succinctly in the American Scholar. I give you one final quotation by way of summary and conclusion. The theory of books is noble. The scholar of the first age received into him the world, brooded thereon, gave it the new arrangement of his own mind and uttered it again. It came into him life. It went out from him truth. It came to him short-lived actions. It went out from him immortal thoughts. It came to him business. It went out from him poetry. It was dead fact. Now it is quick thought. It can stand and it can go. It now endures. It now flies. It now inspires. Precisely in proportion to the depth of mind from which it issued, so high does it soar, so long does it sing. That passage is one of my favorite ones because it addresses the energy of mind which goes into the kind of writing which is able to animate the energy of the reader. And that exchange of energy is going to save us all. Thank you so much for your attention. Thank you.